Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We're talking real estate.
Can I just tell you something?
What?
I have a great uncle who passed away.
Oh, sorry.
He died a couple weeks ago. He was renting a penthouse apartment with balconies on both sides on 96 in Amsterdam, you know, for the past 50 years. I think he was paying like $800 a month. And my brothers and I were always like, should one of us like move in with Uncle Bud and adopt us? But we failed.
We didn't do it.
We didn't get it.
Matt, what's up with that?
Rest in peace.
What do you do for a living? Did you know? Did you ever see, was it the Seinfeld episode? Remember when someone died and they all wanted the apartment?
Yes.
All right. We digress. But we want to talk housing because the U.S. is in what's traditionally the busiest home buying season right now. We got some home data today. U.S. home sales advancing in May at the fastest pace in over a year. So great roundtable to talk about it. Pat Clark is real estate reporter at Bloomberg News here in our Interactive Broker Studio, along with Allison Schrager, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, Bloomberg Opinion columnist. She has a column out about 30-year mortgages in the U.S., and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But Pat, set the stage in terms of the data and where we are in the U.S. housing market.
Yeah, well, we just had a solid increase in home prices from March to April. We're still down a little bit year over year, which is that's been a pattern we've had for the last few months with small monthly increases, but still down a tad. Probably indicates that we are bottoming out and that...
The worst is over, you mean?
Well, the worst is over for home prices. I mean, the housing market is, it's a market. It's two-sided. It's if you own a home, the value of your home is not going to go down more, probably. If you are looking to buy a home, that's bad news.
It's amazing to me, though, that we're not going to go back down from here. I mean, if you look at the S&P Case-Shiller chart, from the beginning of the pandemic until now, prices have just absolutely soared, right? Because everybody wanted to get out of the city and COVID and we needed to distance. But now we don't have to anymore. We're like, calm down.
But
no
they
longer
talk about
freaking
the supply
out.
Being low, right? In terms of the housing
stock? The supply is really low. We're inventory is something just short of half of what it was this time in 2019. But what that really speaks to is that, yes, there was this... there was stimulus. People wanted to go buy a house in the country. People were forming households for the first time. But the prices were also supported by these really low interest rates.
Right.
And those interest rates are locked in.
All right. So let's get to Allison Schrager. Come on in, Allison, on your column today where you talk about the 30-year mortgage could save the U.S. housing market. Lay it out for us.
Well, I mean, I didn't even realize compared to 2008 that almost everyone who's bought a house in the last 10 years has had a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Which means, and I'm one of these people, I locked in a really low interest rate during the pandemic, and effectively, I'm never moving, and that's
congratulations.
Probably,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We were talking about Fed policy and how it lowered rates. I was having a coffee with a member of the Fed board during the pandemic, and I was like, oh, I heard you bought an apartment. I'm like, yeah, it's great. Paid nothing for it. And he goes, you're welcome.
Oh,
that
sweet.
Is great.
Yeah.
By the way, I just looked at the Case-Shiller Index. So from March of 2019 until the peak that we hit in the middle of last year, home prices rose 51%. That's insane froth. Like, how does that not come off?
Wait, what was the starting point?
March of 2019.
Okay.
Oh, I guess that's a little bit too early. I should have started March of 2020.
Okay.
The point is, though, prices have marched higher, and your column, Allison, kind of explains why we're not going to see a lot of movement back to the downside.
Yeah, because if you remember in 2008, what 30% of people had those adjustable rate mortgages. So as rates went up, they couldn't afford it. And in fact, all of a sudden, they found they were underwater. And what's interesting is that pretty much every other rich OECD country is seeing big drops in housing prices, but they also mostly have adjustable rate mortgages too. So the fact that people like us are locked into these very low rates means we're going to be very reluctant to move because, I mean, where can you go?
Can I just highlight
one step? Wait, Pat, did you lock in a low rate, Pat? No, Pat didn't get it.
Can I just say that one stat in your story, by 2021, only 2.2% of mortgage applications were for adjustable rate mortgages, while in 2022, 85% of mortgages were fixed 30-year. Like that number, that's such a flip. It's amazing.
It is, and it's hard to imagine anyone, even if home prices do fall a bit and they find they're underwater with their mortgages, why people would leave. I mean, your monthly outlay is going to just only go up if you go anywhere, even if you downsize.
Demographics, though. I mean, people are getting older. I have nieces and who are getting married, and they're buying homes, and they're starting families and nephews and so on and so forth. I mean, eventually demographics, people will be moving or what?
Well, people are going to want to form households. People are going to need homes, whether that means, can they buy them? It seems like right now, in order to buy them, they're going to have to pay up to get them. They can go rent them, too. I mean, there's a the other side of demographics is at some point people will
die
or at least age out of a place where they want to live in a house in the suburbs and need to be in a community where they're getting more assistance. But that happens very slowly and over time. We imagine the boomers all dying off all at once, but it's not how it really goes.
Well, look at Torsten Slok from Apollo. He sent around a chart, I don't know if you guys are on his list, a couple of weeks ago, showing the average new monthly mortgage payment. And it goes back 20 years. So over the past 20 years, we've been bouncing around between 1,000 and 1,500. And now it's 3,000. So the current average new mortgage payment average across the country, including the middle, is $3,000. That's insane.
I remember when we bought our house years ago, decades ago, and it was like the mortgage was the same as our rent. Like it was just such an easy transition. Having said this, Allison, I think about broader economic implications. If people have great 30-year mortgages like yourself and you ain't moving, what does that mean in terms of economic activity? Because when we buy a house, we tend to buy a lot of stuff. There's just an economic activity component as a result of that movement.
So you mean like people buy other things to go with the house, or are going to want to maybe as well do renovations, stuff like that?
Home Depot, real estate agents, commissions. I mean, everything you can think of associated with buying a house or forming a household, right? That kind of activity is maybe going to lessen substantially, right? If we don't see a lot more transactions.
Yeah, and that way I don't think, anyway, the 30-year mortgage might save us from a housing collapse. I don't think it's all necessarily good, because anyway, it might save us some short-term pain. It's also good to move. Like if you're thinking I want to move to another city for a better job, but the housing costs are just too high because you have to sell your cheap house and go to something with a more expensive mortgage, maybe you won't. And that might make the economy less dynamic. And as you say, younger people forming households might be priced out. That's not good either. So I think we're giving up some short-term pain, but might end up with a sort of just less dynamic economy in the process.
So your takeaway was the 30-year mortgage has kind of saved us from falling off a cliff edge right now.
Versus other countries, right?
Versus what you see in the UK. But in the long term, we're going to lack that dynamism that has made America so great.
Or we'll be less dynamic than we otherwise could be. We're always more dynamic than the UK, but I mean,
true.
It's all relative.
Brexit.
Matt's always dynamic. Papa, come in terms of when you look at the residential real estate market, are home builders getting ready to amp up, buy land and build, or what?
It's a good time to be a home builder because there you're not competing with existing home inventory, right? So I think certainly builders are feeling optimistic and see a great opportunity. What level they actually produce homes into, I guess, is a question. And they got burned 15 years ago.
I feel like they're so cautious.
Along with the rest of us. And they've kind of their business model operates in a way where they're taking less risk, but also are less nimble in terms of capitalizing on opportunity.
Home builder stocks are up almost 50% this year.
Yeah, they're doing very well.
Been on a tear. Okay, thank you. We didn't talk about the Manhattan Loft, 63% discount. How did we not do that?
True. Jennifer Epstein has a great story on the Bloomberg Terminal about a 5,800 square foot loft that may sell for $4 million, which is pretty low for such a gigantic pad, because there's a renter in there that's going to stay forever and only pays $2,300 a month in rent.
That's how it works in New York City. All right, Pat and Allison, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, as we try to figure out when we should go apply to be a Citadel intern, in the meantime, we continue to kind of parse through economic data points, headlines on a lot of things. We talked about residential housing earlier with our team, and we know the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week is all about the office real estate market and noting that it's getting scary. But then we had SL Green yesterday selling a stake in a Park Avenue tower, a value of about $2 billion put on that skyscraper as a result of the deal. And that showed to be, or was looked at, Matt, as some optimism when it comes to the office real estate space.
Yeah, I think.
In certain markets, certain areas.
I won't use the Tale of Two Cities cliche, but clearly there's a difference, right? If you have a great office building on Park Avenue in a place where everybody wants to be, or if you've got one of the buildings on the Third Avenue Canyon down here that nobody wants to work in or will ever be able to live in, there's a very big difference in the value of those assets.
It's not apples to apples. Well, we have a great guest to comment on the commercial real estate world. With us is Michael Chabot. He is founder, chairman, and CEO of the International Real Estate Development and Investment Company that bears his name. His company owns the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco, bought that back in 2020, other properties around the world, and we welcome him in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Hello, hello.
Hello, good morning. Good afternoon.
It's morning somewhere, isn't
it's
it?
It's summer morning,
it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Michael, here at Bloomberg, it's morning.
When Carol and I get our Citadel internships, have you got a place for us to hang out in Miami?
By the way, the Citadel play in Miami is something that everybody's been talking about because, you know, the move of Citadel to Miami from Chicago has been a big generator of kind of other companies moving there. This whole intern thing is a phenomenal marketing tool, right? Now you got every top college grad coming to Citadel. But you know, when you're looking at the market, and you were talking about the SL Green deal, the SL Green deal is interesting. If you go through the details, a lot of it was actually a transfer of debt, right? So the Japanese firm actually took over a bunch of the debt. But the fact that
it was great for SL Green's balance sheet.
It was amazing for SL Green, and the fact that the building is worth more than the debt was a miracle on that specific asset. But as you said, it's not even a tale of two cities. It's a building specific today.
Yeah, that's right.
And the separation between good and not good, or good and really bad, is huge. There's no more in between. It's either you're a winner, which means you're a trophy building. You're generating rents of $200 a foot plus, and that market's on fire, or you're dead. There's no in between, because as you said, nobody wants to go to Third Avenue because those buildings have expired. The idea that real estate lasts forever is something that people are now realizing is probably not true.
By the way, what do you do with those buildings on Third Avenue? Because we've heard from people that look into it, not only does nobody want to work in them as office buildings, but they cannot be repurposed as residential.
I'm going to ask you, when you open your fridge and you see the milk expired, what do you do with the
milk?
Just
throw it away.
Exactly. And that's what's going to happen with these buildings. So when we're looking at these buildings, we don't buy on Third Avenue because it's not our neighborhood. We only focus on super prime real estate. But at some point, the value of those buildings is going to trade at land value. And there will be an opportunity to demolish them and build a new office, a new building. It's not that nobody wants to live there, but you can't convert, you can't take bad stock and make you know, you're not going to take the sour milk and make a cake out of it. It's still going to be a sour cake. And that's really the problem with a lot of these conversations about converting office to resi. It works in really specific cases with buildings that have the right column widths and things of that nature.
Have you been to the Ned, for example? Have you been to the Ned in London?
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
It was a bank, and now it's a really cool hotel with like 9 restaurants.
But once we take down the sour cakes, are we going to build new cakes? In other words, new offices? Or are we going to do something else with that land?
Well, we're in certain cases where there's demand, we're going to build new office. I mean, I'm a big believer that the idea that everybody's working from home is nonsense. You know, pre-COVID, we all remember everybody wanted to be Google, Apple, Facebook. We all wanted big offices, hold hands, you know, and collaborate.
We were there years ago, I'm just going
to
say.
I want to say that.
No,
that
really
every
were.
Time I come to this office, this was built in 2005. What a visionary Mike was to do this, to bring people together, forces you to come together in London as well before you go to your office. This is it's brilliant, and he's a true visionary.
It's a fantastic place to work, and our new office in London, by the way,
phenomenal.
I think Norman Foster designed that as well.
So I just toured that actually with Norman. Norman's designing 4 buildings for us. He's also doing the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco and, you know, a couple of new office buildings in Miami. The building is amazing. But that, just to go back, Carol, to your question, we're going to build office. We're going to build residential. We're going to build the right thing at the time.
Right.
But the value of the land will start making sense.
Go to San Francisco. You bought that Transamerica Pyramid back in 2020. I think it was $650 million. And I know you're putting a ton of money in to renovate it. Any regrets about that property? And help me understand San Francisco.
I'd buy it 5 times again if I could. It's a first thing, as I said, Schmo focuses only on elevating super prime real estate. It doesn't get more prime than the Transamerica Pyramid.
But what's going on at San Francisco? We have a cover story on Business Week. San Francisco's going through a really tough time.
So if you read the press, you know, and you think San Francisco is dead and it's about to sink and the cable cars are going down the ocean. You guys reported recently about the Transamerica Pyramid. We've signed multiple leases between $200 to $250 a foot in the pyramid. Now, that makes the Transamerica Pyramid the 3rd most expensive building in the country. More expensive than the building that SL Green just sold as far as rents, right? It's at the top of the market as rents. And this is in San Francisco, which is a market that in general has a lot of negativity. It shows you that even in difficult markets, there's a flight to quality, and we're getting the investment banks, we're getting, you know, the VCs there that are willing to pay if you give them the right thing. And obviously with Norman Foster, and we're investing hundreds of millions of dollars, we're seeing that. But San Francisco has obviously some existential issues that will eventually get solved. I think that there's a lot of eyes on us with what we're doing at the Pyramid, with how we're going to rejuvenate the park. We have the Redwood Park there to really ignite that whole neighborhood, Jackson Square. And that's going to happen towards the end of the year, early next year. So there's a lot of hope that brings life
back
to downtown.
Did it just get ahead of itself also? I mean, I feel like we've been talking about the housing problems and situations, the expensive nature of San Francisco, a city like San Francisco, for years. So did it just kind of need to right itself, or is it the pandemic?
I think it's a combination. It's the stars aligned in the wrong location. And that says because the pandemic took a hit.
Yeah.
The largest groups that suffered from the pandemic, or in the sense from an office perspective, is the tech tenants, because they all of a sudden figured we can work from home. But that's all changing, right? You're seeing a change of that. And right now we're seeing, even in San Francisco, we're seeing Monday to Thursday, you know, the card swipes right now. People are at the office. Friday is still quite quiet. But all that really means is you got to give people a reason to come.
Our Ed Ludlow, who's in our San Francisco bureau, is listening and says, ask him what's going to happen to downtown San Francisco. Westfield and all the corporate real estate is empty. Everyone wants it rezoned.
So they're working on...
Thank you, Ed.
But again, Ed, part of the issue there is, as I said earlier, not every building works as a conversion to residential. San Francisco, from all market, needs it more than anything else because housing prices are out of control. You know, unemployment in San Francisco is sub 3% today, which is something really important to understand. People are there. There is going to be a back to work, but we will see the bad stock exactly like Third Avenue. As you were talking about the creators of Third Avenue, there are buildings that expired in San Francisco and in every market. Chicago is no different, and New York is no different. We have to get rid of the buildings that are not relevant anymore. And build new buildings instead of them. And that's a transformation. That's where we're going right now. COVID has accelerated all this thing that was going to happen anyway.
I would love to hear
your take on New York, because San Francisco, when I see that rents are going down there, it just makes me excited because I want to live there and maybe I can afford it one day.
So beautiful.
Miami, obviously, it is white hot. Not just Citadel. I mean, even before Ken Griffin thought about moving to Miami, everybody wanted to be there. But New York feels kind of dead. You know, even on this block, we had all of these big tenants downstairs, and those stores are empty still, right? J. Crew and Victoria's Secret and
Uncle Bud's.
They're all
apartment.
Gone. So I just wonder what happens to New York.
Well, you had the Container Store. That went away, right?
Yes.
We had H&M. It's gone.
We used to have Williams Sonoma and Pottery Barn. They left, and I asked them, I go, why are you leaving? It's a great place to be. And they're like, it got too expensive.
Right. So
you
again,
got 20 seconds, then we're going to bring you back.
Okay. Well, there was an issue with, obviously, the cost. As you said, the cost went up. They couldn't afford it. The business interruption. But you're seeing, if you look at Madison rents went up from, it was $1,000 a foot down to $400. You're back at $900 a foot on Madison. There is a bounce back in the locations where people want to be.
All right, we're going to continue with Michael Chavot. He is founder, chairman, and CEO of Chavot Real Estate. They are doing deals, and we're going to continue talking real estate. We want to roll into the conversation, though, also our Ed Ludlow, who, of course, is co-host of Bloomberg Technology, because we've had some news on the EV space. But before we get into it, you know, you really kind of popped in some good questions on San Francisco. You're living in the San Francisco area. Do you buy that San Francisco is going to be okay?
I don't buy it in either direction. I ask the question because it's what the debate is here among everyone, residents, the industry. We had our Bloomberg Technology Summit last week, Michael, and the future of SF was everything that people were talking about alongside AI. And the mayor, London Breed, was here. And I think what we're talking about is downtown SF. The real estate you're talking about. And the mayor's proposal is that investors buy in and redevelop existing or knock it down and do something new with what's already there. And my question to you, Michael, is how attractive is that as an investor to get involved in a project to reimagine what downtown SF looks like?
So you're asking the person that has the largest investment in downtown San Francisco. We have $1 billion invested at the Transamerica Pyramid Center, which is a full city block. I've had multiple conversations with the mayor about this whole idea. These things take time. It's not happening in 5 minutes. And the biggest issue San Francisco has and has had for a long time is bureaucracy of getting things approved, right? So now there's an emergency. They're trying to push everything quickly, which is good because I think that's going to make a change, but it's still going to take time. That is not going to be the immediate solution. There's a security issue in San Francisco that has to be dealt with. And it's this cycle where there's no people, so there's more crime.
How do you deal with that? It doesn't seem like that will be dealt with. I remember going to San Francisco 10 years ago to interview people around an Apple product release, and Chris Sacca had to break up a fight between two homeless people behind us because they didn't know who owned the joint, right? So, I mean, the homeless issue has been a problem for decades.
A long time.
That's not going to get solved.
Well, but you didn't feel the homeless issue when you had people on the street, right? Part of the issue with the homeless issue, when there's nobody on the street, then it's mostly homeless, and the ratio between homeless to non-homeless people is upside down. You feel it a lot more, right? And that's where you start seeing crime. That's where you're seeing drugs. I mean, this whole area in San Francisco that's problematic. But on the bright side, think about what's happening. You're asking what's going to change. What I think is going to change is that you have voters, and there's tremendous amount of pressure on the mayor and on the entire board there to make a difference. You know, they've changed some of the people there, both on the education side and to fight crime. If you ask me if they're doing enough, it's probably not enough yet, but they're at least directionally going there because they know that there is no option. And unfortunately, the press has been very brutal on San Francisco, but it did give a kick in the butt to everybody there to move forward. But I think that what's interesting and why I find it fascinating is, as I said earlier, if we're getting rents between $200 and $250 a foot,
yes,
which is twice the market in San Francisco pre-COVID, this building was at $65 to $105. Today we're at $120 to $250, trending to
$300. Right?
That tells you that there is a first thing that San Francisco is not dead. There is a belief at the top of the market, right, that people want to be there, right? So at the relevant real estate, at the relevant locations, I think that we're going to see positive news. And like I said, there's a lot of eyes on us you know, towards the end of this year,
right,
really to be to ignite downtown San Francisco with opening the pyramid and opening the park and opening that whole neighborhood.
Ed, I want to bring you in because initially we wanted to talk to you about what's going on at Stellantis, and I'm thinking about EV charging units, right? You've got another kind of Stellantis taking a page from Tesla's playbook in terms of lining up other automakers, and we can talk about EV infrastructure. Tell us the news, though.
Okay, so summing up the news from Stellantis, they're basically making a standalone power unit, much like Tesla has. So down the road, they can offer the charging at home infrastructure, energy storage, and then the charging products. The thing is, we don't know anything about it. It's going to be through third-party partnerships, investments through their venture arm. And in this country, Matt's probably thinking, what is he talking about? In this country, Stellantis has no EV offering at all.
Yet.
So, you know, they are so behind the curve here. I think the big question for everyone is, do they join the NACS club, which we discussed last week, right? They joined Tesla's technology standard. But this is at least Stellantis making squeaks. Raises a good point for Michael, though, Carol, which is, you know, where does the energy come from? The private sector or the public sector? Always talking about the infrastructure bill, but, you know, the private sector just gets going quicker. It just does it. Like Tesla just did it in the case of its charging network.
Michael, how do you think about this stuff?
So we just completed the Mandarin Oriental Residences in Beverly Hills on Wilshire Boulevard. And you know, in California, obviously, as you know, EVs are extremely popular. I think, you know, a third of our parking spaces are actually all facilitated with a private charging station. And we provide that to people that move in. And that's where you're seeing, as you said, the private sector is much quicker to react because there's a true ROI, right? If I have a guy that wants to buy or a family that wants to buy an apartment that the 4-bedroom and needs three charging stations, there's a true ROI in providing these facilities versus, you know, waiting for the government to do it or waiting for public funds for that.
So it's becoming a bigger part, right? Is it becoming a bigger part of you as you develop?
For sure, on the West Coast.
On the West Coast.
I think that it's really the mindset of the consumer. The West Coast consumer is very focused, and there's a lot of demand for EVs.
But don't you have to plan ahead? Like if you're putting up a building or you know, re-engineering a building here in New York, if you're building something in Miami, don't you have to say, like, okay, as Ed pointed out, Stellantis doesn't have electric vehicles in America this year, but in 2 or 3 years, they're going to have a ton of them. And so eventually, you know, I mean, you've got to think 5, 10, 25, 30 years ahead, right?
Or do you?
I'm thinking about my internship at Citadel. But the answer to the question is yes. New York is a unique market. We don't build a lot of parking here.
True. And good point. Yeah.
You know, there was just a change, change that you see now with the taxes on traffic that was proposed yesterday here in New York City. But in Miami, for sure, Miami is another market that we are incorporating EV charging stations. The whole energy, you know, the building we're building with Norman Foster in Miami Beach is an energy efficient building where very much like your headquarters in London, you know, being environmentally friendly and environmentally neutral.
Where's your favorite place for opportunities or to build right now when you look around the globe?
And let me ask you about the U.S. versus the rest of the world on that note.
Good point.
Because right now, America's going through a tough time. My wife's from Spain, and she has issues with our government and our people, you know. But how do you look at it as someone who immigrated here also, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, that's a loaded question. We don't have that much time left to even answer that. But if you think about how other people look at, how foreigners look at America, we're still looked at the best place to invest. Huh. And that's, it goes back to the SL Green Deal. The Japanese just put tremendous amount of investment in here because the U.S. is looked at as the safest place to invest. Europe is a disaster from an investment point of view. They have, you know, Spain, Germany, I mean, these markets have tremendous amount of problems. We all have the same issue with cost of capital, right? Cost of capital is expensive here, it's expensive in Europe. But there's the sense that the U.S. is a more advanced market and a safer market to invest. So we're seeing, I mean, we're partners with some of the largest German state-owned pension funds and insurance companies. They're still investing in the U.S., more and more now here than they are in their own backyard because they do have problems there that have to do with
Well, the regulations are just off the hook.
And for years, they were in very low return environment that now is with high cost of capital, it just kills you.
Yeah.
So, Michael, 30 seconds left here. So I'm not going to poo-poo some of the journalism that we've all been doing and the narrative out there about the concerns about office real estate. But do you think there is a crisis brewing? And just got about 30 seconds, 25.
It's as you said. It's not a crisis. It's not an overall market. There's a crisis in the B and C class office, and it's not a crisis. That has expired. It's got to be demolished. It's got to be replaced.
I talked to someone who was overseeing kind of all of the old assets from like Sears and so on and so forth, and just saying, you know, I'm so glad we're not talking about the demise of the mall anymore. Like, we've moved on to office, and it just sounds like we're cleaning house at this point, just a little bit.
There's a reset, and like I said, old inventory out, new inventory in, and people are paying for it. The good thing is there's a lot of money out there to pay for new inventory.
Come back soon. This was really, really fun.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Michael Chavo, he's founder, chairman, and CEO of the company that bears his name here in our Interactive Brokers.
And thanks, Ed.
Yes, thank you, Ed Ludlow.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us. You drive me
crazy. This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 17 minutes left in today's trading session here on this Tuesday, June 27th. And as you heard from Charlie, equity's definitely on a rally. Outperformance among the NASDAQ, 1.7% higher. And maybe some expectations that the upbeat U.S. economic data, that the economy maybe won't fall apart, or if we get a recession, it'll be easy. But we have seen also rates moving up a little bit today, Matt.
Right. And the concern, I think, if you're buying into this market, is that rates need to rise further.
Yeah, but maybe.
As has been indicated by Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve dot plot, but the markets don't seem to buy it.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to it. Christopher Zook is with us, founder, chairman, and chief investment officer of CAZ Investments, works with endowments, high net worth individuals, and family offices. He joins us on Zoom in Houston. Hey, Chris, good to have you back with us. First up, I got to ask you about Houston temperatures, Texas records. Talk to us about the heat and the stress, the grid stresses, because it's something we're going to dig into a little bit deeper. But I'm curious firsthand what you guys are seeing.
You know, it's amazing. We had a very actually mild start to this spring and the early part of summer, and then it has really hit with a vengeance here the last couple of weeks. You know, the grid is under stress. What I will tell you is that most of the things that were done after the freeze that we dealt with in 2021 have really improved the health of the grid, and the leadership, you know, of the new leadership that has taken over there has really done a very, very good job. So far, even though it is very hot here, It's 72 degrees everywhere you go, your car, your office, and your home, because that grid is very much intact.
All right, so you're staying cool with the AC on. Markets are hot right now. We're up again today, or we've broken the losing streak of the last couple of days. 1.2% on the S&P, another 1.75% on the NASDAQ. These tech stocks continue to run. How much longer can this go on, Chris?
You know, it's hard because of the fact that the market could be anticipating either a soft landing or an economic recovery on the other side, or the market could just be flat out wrong. And right now, it feels like we have this huge dichotomy to where in the S&P 500, 20 names have made up over 90%. 4% of the names have made up over 90% of the performance of the S&P 500 year to date. So we have this dichotomy where it looks like the bond market is wrong because the stock market is going up. I personally believe, and we believe as a firm, that the bond market is right and the stock market is wrong, and that this is going to end badly over the summertime and the fall as the recession really does arrive.
Having said that, if I look at the S&P 500 major industry groups, most of them are up on the year. And yep, it is some of those big tech names that are definitely leading the way. Communication services, that oddly named group, but nonetheless. But consumer discretionary, industrials are also gaining on the year. Materials, you know, there are, we were for a while, it feels like, Chris, you know, talking about some of the plain vanilla old industrial stocks that were leading the way and we were seeing some rotation. So having said that, does that not speak to you that maybe things are a little bit more broader in terms of the outperformance? And maybe it makes sense for tech to be such an outperformer and big influence considering our world is so much tech.
You know, those are very fair points and very fair questions. And at one point, there was the appearance, based on what was happening in the bond market and in the stock market, that the Federal Reserve was going to be able to thread the needle and to be able to manufacture a slowing economy, beat inflation, and then at the same time not destroy earnings and profit margins. Really doesn't look like that is the case right now. But FOMO is kicking back in again, fear of missing out on the rally that is causing people to go, okay, what is not absurdly expensive? And so you are seeing a little bit more participation, but the actual indices themselves, they're still not performing like you would expect them to when you look at what the overall stock market has done, when you look at the S&P and when you look at the NASDAQ. What I will say is this. Most people right now believe the Fed is going to raise rates more, but yet they're trading stocks like that's not going to happen. That, to me, is a message of hope, and hope is a bad investment strategy.
I'm just going to tell you, Chris and Matt, that sounds like when my husband's like, yeah, honey, you know, fair point, but, you know, you're wrong. So it's okay.
Would I ever do that? No, I would not do that.
No, I hope you would. I hope you would push back. I hope you would. But anyway.
In terms of, you know, I've seen this hope playing out when I go to lunch with Wall Street fund managers who are like, yeah, the Fed's got to cut. They're definitely going to cut, you know. Do you expect Powell to, I guess it, at this point, he'd be kind of reneging on his promise because he said last week they're not going to cut for years.
I think that it is definitely wrong to think that the Federal Reserve is going to turn around and go the other way. The Fed is in one of the most difficult boxes that they have been in the last 40 years. If they raise rates too much, they know they're going to derail the economy and do so in a pretty significant way. But they may have to do that to whip inflation, to use the term of the early 80s. But at the same time, if they lower rates because the economy starts to show that recessionary environment, and then all of a sudden inflation rears its ugly head again, then they look like they're completely incompetent, the markets lose confidence, and that is exactly what happened to the Federal Reserve in the late 70s, early 80s. They cannot lower rates until they know for sure that inflation has been beaten to the ground and that they have literally laid on top of it for a while to make sure that it's going to stay down.
That is
when they're going to cut rates, and that's probably not any time in the next 12 to 18
months. Don't you feel
like
Jay Powell was just throwing cold water at everybody, basically saying, come on, guys, stop talking about cutting rates already. That just doesn't make any sense. We're not even close. You know, but as I just texted or messaged to IB to Matt, data dependent. I mean, the Fed's going to watch the data points. If inflation gets down and settles, you know, they certainly don't want a deep, deep recession either. Just got about 30 seconds, Chris.
Totally agree with you. And if they literally do see data that completely surprises people and the inflation is whooped,
yeah,
and then you don't see this bad recession coming, you know, there's no reason for them to keep raising rates.
Hey, listen, so, 20 seconds, because you do make investment decisions. What's your favorite investment play against risk right now? Very quickly.
Absolutely. Owning the stakes in private asset management firms. They have the biggest tailwind. They have the best profit margins, the most predictability, and the most upside.
Got a favorite ticker?
So in the public markets right now, we do own OWL, Blue OWL. That would be our favorite as far as the names in the public markets.
Love that we got it in. Well, stay cool. Christopher Zook, founder, chairman, and chief investment officer at CAZ Investments, on Zoom from a pretty warm Houston. Carol Masser, Matthew Miller, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.